The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles principally from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and the first article is about bariatric surgery, an important weight loss tool. Losing weight is hard. Keeping it off is often harder. Sometimes it's possible to achieve and maintain weight loss with diet, exercise, and weight loss medication. Other times, these measures aren't enough. Bariatric surgery is the most effective way for those with severe obesity to lose excess weight and keep it off long term. Research has shown that bariatric surgery recipients are able to lose and keep off an average of about 20 to 35% of their total body weight after 5 to 10 years. This weight loss can help prevent or improve weight-related diseases and conditions like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, joint problems, sleep apnea, and type 2 diabetes. It also can reduce the risk of certain cancers and increase quality of life. However, bariatric surgery is major surgery with serious risks, and it requires a lot of work before and after to ensure success. Mayo Clinic experts say that bariatric surgery is a weight management tool that needs to be used with others, like physical activity, careful diet, and weight loss medications, to help achieve lasting weight loss and optimal health. Who it's for. Bariatric surgery is typically reserved for people with a body mass index of 40 or higher, or with a body mass index of 35 or higher, and a weight-related health problem like type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, or severe sleep apnea. Growing knowledge about obesity and evidence of the effectiveness and relative safety of bariatric surgery led the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery to publish alternative recommendations in 2022. The new criteria steer bariatric surgeries toward those with lower BMIs. A BMI of 35 or higher, or a BMI of 24.9 to 30 if there is a weight-related problem. Bariatric surgery is not always covered by insurance. Even if it is covered or partially covered, it may add up to considerable expense. If you're considering bariatric surgery, you'll likely undergo an extensive screening and preparation process. You'll meet with a team of professionals that might include dietitians, psychologists, surgeons, and endocrinologists. This team evaluates whether surgery is a good option and prepares you for long-term success. You'll likely be asked to quit smoking, make diet changes, increase physical activity, and participate in counseling. Bariatric surgeries work by altering the way you absorb nutrients, by limiting how much food your stomach can hold, or both. Most bariatric surgeries today are laparoscopic, or robotic surgeries, meaning they are performed through small incisions. These procedures typically produce the most weight loss in the first 6 to 12 months after surgery. Weight loss then slows and stabilizes at around 1 to 2 years after the operation. The first kind of surgery that's sometimes done is called gastric bypass, or RUNY, that's RUX-EN-Y. The surgeon cuts and staples across the top of the stomach, disconnecting it from the rest of the stomach to make a new, smaller stomach pouch. Then the surgeon cuts the small intestine below the main part of the stomach and reconnects the intestine to the new pouch. Food will flow into this small pouch and then directly into the small intestine. the main part of the stomach remains in the body and continues to make digestive juices. The portion of the intestine still attached to the main stomach is reattached about 5 feet down the small intestine so that the juices can enter the small intestine. The new pouch can only hold about 0.5 to 1 fluid ounce, drastically decreasing the amount of food you can comfortably eat in one sitting. It also reduces nutrient absorption, because food is diverted around portions of the stomach and small intestine. One large study showed that, on average, people who underwent gastric bypass lost and kept off 25.5% of their body weight at 5 years. A second procedure is called sleeve gastrectomy. The surgeon creates a small, narrow stomach sleeve by stapling and dividing off a portion of the stomach. About 80% of the stomach is stapled off and removed. This surgery doesn't affect your small intestine. The smaller stomach can't hold as much food, which limits the amount you'll be able to eat at one time. After surgery, your body makes less of the appetite-stimulating hormone ghrelin, which decreases the desire to eat. The same large study showed an average 5-year weight loss of 18.8% of body weight after sleeve gastrectomy. Then there's biliopancreatic diversion with duodenal switch, or BPD/DS. The first step of this surgery removes most of the stomach to make a sleeve-shaped pouch, as in sleeve gastrectomy. The next step reroutes the small intestine. The surgeon makes a cut in the first section of the small intestine, known as the duodenum, and a second cut farther down. These divided intestine ends are reconnected in a way that allows food to bypass a large segment of the small intestine. The separated section of the intestine isn't removed from the body. One end of this section is still connected to the pancreas and bile ducts. The other end is surgically reattached to the lower small intestine, allowing bile and pancreatic digestive juices to enter this part of the intestine. This surgery limits how much you can eat and significantly reduces nutrient absorption. While it's very effective, it has a greater risk, including malnutrition and vitamin deficiencies. This procedure is generally reserved for people with a higher BMI, or those who don't adequately respond to other weight loss procedures, like the sleeve gastrectomy. One small study found that people lost about 36% of their total body weight 10 years or more after this procedure. To lose weight and keep it off after surgery, you'll need to stick to healthy eating habits. And since you'll be eating much less food, the quality of your diet is very important. Directly after surgery, you will need to acclimate to your new digestive system by changing slowly from a liquid diet to soft foods and then solid foods. The full process generally takes about 6 to 12 weeks. After you progress to solid foods, you'll still need to be careful with your diet so you can lose weight, maintain weight loss, and limit side effects. Generally, you'll want to emphasize protein, stay hydrated, and limit sugar. Because weight loss surgery limits the amount of nutrients you can eat and absorb, you will take certain vitamin and mineral supplements like multivitamins, calcium, vitamin B12, and vitamin D for the rest of your life. Other nutritional deficiencies can also occur, making it very important to follow up with your care team on a regular basis. After the original surgery, some people may need additional procedures. These may include treatments for emergency leakage. If the staple line or connection of the small intestine to another part of the intestine or stomach doesn't heal fully, it can leak. This is an uncommon but potentially deadly complication. If you have increased pain in your abdomen, fever, or a consistently fast pulse during the first few weeks after surgery, let your health care team know right away or seek emergency medical care. If you've had a gastric bypass and the opening between your stomach and small intestine becomes too large, you'll regain your ability to consume more food at once. This can contribute to increased hunger and weight regain. An endoscopic procedure known as transoral outlet reduction, or TORE, can tighten this junction. Losing a lot of weight may leave you with folds of extra skin. Plastic surgery can remove excess skin through a procedure known as body contouring or paniculectomy. This is typically not done for at least 18 to 24 months after bariatric surgery, after weight loss is stable. Insurance may not pay for this surgery. It's essential that you go to checkups and follow all nutrition and medication instructions after bariatric surgery. This helps prevent complications and aids in detecting problems early. Regular physical activity is important to maintain your weight and keep your functioning at your best. Obesity is often a lifelong concern, and setbacks are common. If you regain weight after your surgery, don't despair. There are options that can help, including behavioral intervention, weight loss medication, and procedures like TORE. Don't make this journey alone. Support from your care team, friends, family, a mental health professional, and online or in-person support groups can make a big difference. There's also a small segment called alcohol after bariatric surgery. After gastric bypass, it appears the body absorbs alcohol more readily and faster and doesn't get rid of it as quickly. Studies have demonstrated that when given the same amount of alcohol, people who've had a gastric bypass reach higher breath and blood alcohol levels and reach them more quickly than those who haven't undergone the surgery. A recent study in JAMA Surgery found out that those who underwent gastric bypass were at increased risk of hospitalization related to alcohol use disorder, as compared with those who received a sleeve gastrectomy and those who participated in a non-surgical weight management program. People who have undergone other types of bariatric surgery also should be cautious about alcohol consumption due to changes in body weight, digestion, and absorption. It's best to avoid all alcohol after bariatric surgery. If you're having trouble controlling your alcohol intake after bariatric surgery, reach out to your health care team. Now, for a little change of pace, I'm going to read a section called Second Opinion in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first question is, there's a health screening van coming to our church. Are these worth using? And the answer is, probably not. Mobile health screening services usually mean that you'll be screened using ultrasound for a variety of health conditions. The machines themselves aren't a problem. Using ultrasound for diagnostics and therapy is on the cutting edge of technological advancement. Ultrasound doesn't pose any safety risks, but Mayo Clinic experts generally advise against such direct-to-consumer screening tests. The screening tests aren't likely to uncover meaningful health risks that aren't already detected by regular visits with your healthcare team and age-appropriate, guideline-driven screening tests. Thus, you're paying for testing that you probably already are getting or don't need. Further, the general nature of the tests can create unnecessary trips for health care and panic over fears about conditions you likely don't have. You're usually better off saving your money and keeping current on medical checkups. Be wary of marketing claims that sound too good to be true. Question: I've been about 10 pounds overweight for a few years. No matter what I do, more exercise, healthy eating, nothing seems to budge the scale. Am I doing something wrong? Answer: you're probably not doing anything wrong. Your body may be fighting back against weight loss by increasing your appetite and spending less energy. Weight loss is harder for some people due to genetic factors. With aging, weight loss also may be more difficult due to decreased activity. People with more muscle burn more calories, and people tend to lose muscle with age. Excess weight can increase the risk of health problems like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, heart disease, sleep apnea, and joint pain. If you developed any of these complications, losing weight may prevent these problems from getting worse or even improve them. But if you eat healthfully, are active, and don't have weight-related health problems, Mayo Clinic experts say that a small amount of excess weight isn't likely to do much harm. You can release the stress of trying to drop those last stubborn pounds. If you do have weight-related health problems, or your weight is affecting your quality of life, talk with your healthcare team for support in developing a structured weight loss plan. Now here's an interesting article called "Psychedelics in Psychiatry: Showing Promise, but Caution is Needed." Acid, ecstasy, shrooms. The names probably evoke an image of young people gathered at a party, doing things forbidden by both their parents and the law. Yet these drugs, which fall under the category of psychedelics, have gained a different reputation in recent decades. Researchers are testing psychedelics to see if the mood-altering trips they produce can help treat mental health conditions like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, also called PTSD, and addiction disorders. These drugs also have the potential to provide relief as part of end-of-life care. They are being studied mostly as options when other treatments are not effective. While results are promising, the long-term outlook is unclear. The psychedelics attracting the most research attention are discussed here. The first is psilocybin, that's psilocybin. This is the active ingredient in psychedelic mushrooms. In the United States, psilocybin is legal only in one state, Oregon, where adults may take a dose of the drug in pill form under the care of trained mental health professionals. However, psilocybin has not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. The drug produces a euphoric feeling during the roughly 6 hours of a standard trip and may leave an afterglow that can last for months. Psilocybin has shown promise in treating nicotine addiction, alcohol use disorder, and depression. Next is ketamine. This drug is a chemical compound developed by researchers in the 1950s to replace phencyclidine, or PCP, which is commonly known as angel dust. The goal was to create a drug with similar ability to produce pain relief without the severe side effects of PCP. Ketamine is the only psychedelic that's remained legal in medical use, allowing researchers to study long-term effects. In recent decades, its possibilities as a secondary treatment for depression have attracted significant research interest. It's used in two forms. The first is IV-infused ketamine. This is an FDA-approved anesthetic for surgical and medical procedures. In recent years, ketamine has increasingly been used for treatment-resistant depression, though this is an off-label use. Ketamine delivered in low doses can provide rapid relief of TRD, or treatment-resistant depression, and relief lasts for days to weeks. Usually, it's given in decreasing frequency over several weeks, starting with two doses a week for 2 to 3 weeks, then tapering off. Response rates are as high as 70% in clinical trials involving regular infusions. Then there's another drug called esketamine, or Spravato, S-P-R-A-V-A-T-O. This drug was approved in 2019 to treat treatment-resistant depression. Its rapid delivery system means depression symptoms can ease within several hours. Esketamine is administered as a squirt in each nostril, followed by a 2-hour monitoring period. Standard dosing involves taking the medication twice a week for about 4 weeks, then switching to once a week for another 4 weeks, then tapering off over time. Research has shown that esketamine can significantly reduce depression symptoms, relief that can last for weeks after the treatment ends. Then there's MDMA, which is also known as ecstasy. This drug was developed as a potential treatment for blood clotting in 1912, then was shelved for many decades, and then reemerged in a new form in the 1970s. It's long been used and misused as a street drug, and it is illegal for sale or use by the general public in the United States. Studies in the past 2 decades have found that the drug, when given in a controlled environment with a mental health professional present, can significantly improve symptoms for people with PTSD. The FDA granted it designation as a breakthrough therapy for PTSD in 2017, clearing the way for continuing clinical trials. Then there's LSD, or lysergic acid diethylamide. Known by its street name, acid, this drug was studied extensively in the 1950s and 1960s for a range of mental health conditions. It showed the most promise in reducing problem drinking. Small studies have found benefits for mood disorders and anxiety. Don't try psychedelics on your own. In recent years, the practice of taking low-dose psychedelic drugs, usually on a recurring basis and outside of the care of a medical team, has become more popular. It's known as microdosing. Mayo Clinic experts strongly advised against this approach for these reasons. It's potentially unsafe. These drugs have the potential for damaging side effects. Some people experience headache and nausea. Because some psychedelics increase serotonin, there is a potential for interaction with certain antidepressants and other drugs that affect serotonin levels. The drugs have unpredictable and often negative effects on people with psychiatric conditions, such as schizophrenia. And the drugs can cause mood swings and unpredictable behaviors, even at small doses. Nearly all major studies of psychedelic drugs have involved using full-dose treatments in a controlled environment. Medical professionals oversee the dose given and are present over the entire resulting trip to monitor participants' reactions. Because approaches like microdosing haven't been studied as extensively, the benefits and risks are less known. Owning, using, and selling psychedelic drugs outside a medical setting violates state and federal laws. Don't put yourself in legal jeopardy. And then there's a small attached article that's called 3 Things to Know About Psychedelics. The research goes way back. A psychiatrist coined the term psychedelic in 1957. These drugs were studied extensively in the 1950s and 1960s for treatment of psychiatric conditions. That stopped in 1970 when the United States government passed the Controlled Substance Act, criminalizing most psychedelic drugs. The legislation came as the street forms of these psychedelics became associated with the protests and social unrest of the late 1960s. Research resumed in the 1990s and has dramatically increased since 2010. The effects aren't well understood. Researchers still don't fully understand how psychedelics work or why they help some health conditions. Broadly speaking, the drugs act as disruptors, causing brief but powerful interruptions to important circuits in the brain. Doing so allows the brain to reboot. Existing memories and associations that produce anxiety and pain may get blunted. Further, psychedelics may help new pathways and connections form in the brain, a process called neuroplasticity. Some psychedelics affect serotonin, a chemical messenger in the brain that's related to mood. They are not risk-free. Although psychedelics don't generally carry the same degree of risk for overuse and addiction as other street drugs, they can cause unwanted side effects, even when used in a medical setting. In addition, the long-term and lasting effects aren't fully understood. Use them only under the close supervision of a trained mental health professional. In the interest of time, I think I'm going to stop reading at this point, and I will resume this issue next time. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.